Hey there, sex fans, welcome back. Today is Wednesday, September 12th, 2012, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge.
Who is this?
Why, I'm your host, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. Today I welcome back Dr. Daryl Ray, therapist, educator, lecturer, and author of The God Virus, and Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality, to this, the Sex Wisdom Show. And I'm so glad that he has more time to spend with us, because part one of our conversation, which appeared here last week, was a real revelation. No pun intended.
That feels really powerful.
You can say that again. So, for all of you who have yet to visit David on his site, recoveringfromreligion.org, I hope that you'll get to that right away because it's pretty amazing. You can find his books at ipcpress.com, and of course he's on Facebook and Twitter too. Look for all these links in today's podcast posting on drdicksexadvice.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by Dr. Dick's Stockroom. You'll find this treasure trove of sexually stimulating toys, implements, fetish wear, and gear right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the Dr. Dick's Stockroom banner in the sidebar of my site.
This is ridiculous.
Actually, it's not so ridiculous, because you know why? You'll surely enjoy shopping at Dr. Dick's Stockroom because it's just so damn fun and, I might add, easy. Yes, Resex fans, you can spare yourself the embarrassment of skulking down to your local sex emporium to pick up all those nasty toys you've been drooling over. You can forget about seedy storefronts in unsavory neighborhoods, and you don't have to worry about leering salesmen scrutinizing what you buy. Why? Because you shop from the privacy of your own computer. That's why. Thanks to Dr. Dick's Stockroom, it's never been easier or more discreet to be a big fat pervert. Be sure to take a moment out of your hectic schedule and visit my stockroom today. And remember, a portion of every sale comes back to us as support for these shows. How great is that? Okay, on with the show. Daryl Ray, thank you for coming back to DrDickSexAdvice.com for this Sex Wisdom podcast. I'm so glad that we have more time, and thank you for giving us this more time, because I just got to the was getting to the marrow of you last week, and I wanted more. So let's pick up precisely where we left off last week. We were talking about sexual maps. And we talked about sexual mythology. And one of the things that I think I know is that there are zillions of religious myths, and so much of religious mythology has to do with sex and sexual practices: menstruation, masturbation, adultery, virginity, sexual abstinence, sodomy, circumcision, monogamy, and the list goes on and on. All these prohibitions are designed to control human sexual appetite. What gives rise to all of this, do you suppose?
Well, I see it as a part of what I call the guilt cycle.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, and the guilt cycle is something you learn very early on. From very early on, you are told babies have their hands pushed away when they touch their own genitals. We know that babies are touching themselves in utero. So
yes.
We know they're pleasuring themselves. And yet, from very early on, you're told, don't touch yourself. Don't look at naked people. We have sexualized things that are so natural, like breastfeeding.
Yes.
Breastfeeding has been sexualized in our culture. And it's kind of ironic because I just got back from Europe not long ago and, you know, took tours of the St. Petersburg, and here's this beautiful piece of art with the Virgin Mary breastfeeding Jesus.
Yes.
and it's all right there for you to see.
Right.
Even in the Renaissance, there was no sexualization of breastfeeding, and yet we have managed to do that. So you've got to create this sense that there's something wrong with sex. And, of course, go clear back to the story of Adam and Eve. Adam didn't control his wife, and they realized they were naked. So nudity is now sexualized in the very chapter of the very first book of the Bible. And then you come along with St. Paul, and St. Paul says that, you know, we are all paying for the sins of this guy named Adam and this horrible woman named Eve who led him astray. And so women are getting double and triple the punishment right. the man
right.
gets.
Right.
Once you teach people at a very young age, I mean, these stories are taught to children in three, four, 5 years old.
Yeah.
So they're being taught that sex and nudity, touching yourself, all these things are terrible. And then once you get older and your hormones start flowing and you touch yourself, you realize, oh, I'm a bad person. I'm like that Adam guy or that Eve gal.
Right.
That was the guilt comes in.
Right.
Now, what I've also noticed is each religion has its own what I call guilt pattern. The Mormons have their guilt pattern, and it's different than the Catholics, but it's still a guilt pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Violate whatever you learned in that religion. The only place you can get relief from the guilt that wells up within you is by going back to that religion. Have you ever heard of a Mormon confessing their sins to a Catholic priest? When a Catholic priest, Mormons come in and confess their sins to you. Catholics confess their sins to Muslim imams.
Yes.
They don't. The only place you can get rid of this guilt is the place you learned the guilt in the first place.
Right. Curiously enough.
That's why I call it the guilt cycle.
Right.
You have to come back to the place you learned the guilt. And that's why all these things are being taught to people very, very early on.
But the curious thing is that all of these rules and regulations are man-made. And if you took out the thus saith the Lord business, you know, people would see right through it. You know, just like, you know, why should I cut the tip of my dick off? You know,
right.
Why? That doesn't make any sense. But if you add, thus saith the Lord, then, oh, okay, I'm going to, you know, mutilate my son's penis because, you know, God told me to do it. But that just, you know, we get really trapped in that. And if we just peeled back the veil of thus says the Lord and looked at the dictums, you know, for what they really are, we would see right through them, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Let's go back to the concept of the map, because I think this ties it all together.
Okay, cool.
We talked about the first two maps, but the third map is the one the culture is trying to put on us, and especially the religion. When you're growing up and these hormones are flowing, you are looking for the map of how am I supposed to behave in this particular environment. If you were born in the outback of Australia to an Aborigine, you would be given one sexual map. It would be very different from somebody growing up in Italy in the 15th century.
Right.
It would be, so every culture tends to try and put its map of sexuality on that person. The maps are available. You know, that's the only map you have. There's no alternative map in the 1500s if you're a boy growing up in Italy.
Right.
There's just that map. And if you're growing up in, you know, in Calvinist Switzerland in the 1700s, there's no other map.
Right.
So you absorb whatever map it is, and your hormones are so strong, they're programmed. You're going to go where you're going to absorb this map, and this map is going to tell you what your hormones are telling you to do is wrong.
Right.
So here we start seeing the genetic map 1 and map 2, in conflict with map 3. That's where all this conflict comes from. That's where all this self-hatred comes from.
Right.
It's where the hatred of other people comes from. And until you understand how each of these maps are working and how they actually conflict with each other, then you know, once you understand that, you can say, oh, so my Christian map is telling me to do things that my biological and my epigenetic maps say not to, or to do the opposite.
Right, exactly.
I think it helps people start examining the map they were given.
Right.
I think as non-religious people, we need to really look at the map we were given. I know atheists who are still uptight.
Oh, tell me.
So why are we uptight? It's because we absorbed this map uncritically.
Yes.
Before our rational immune system was able to critically analyze the map we were being given.
Right. So we touched on this last week, but I want to come around to it again this week. Effective religious control over people is absolutely dependent on stifling critical thinking among its adherents. So groupthink is the only option. Of course, when there is no checks and balances on this absolute authority, the most egregious things happen, like the international clergy sex abuse scandal that is engulfing the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I think that's there's just so much that can be hidden when there's no alternative maps
right.
out there.
Right.
When you think yours is the only map, and that's what you were taught.
I mean, yes, absolutely.
You were given no alternative maps, no choice in this.
And when I started to think critically, you know, and think, well, holy cow, there's all these other people out there thinking other ways. Ought we not at least take a look at them? You know, that was, you know, like verboten. That was absolutely forbidden.
Right, right. Well, you are taught to even question is a sin.
Yes, absolutely.
But it's not just Catholics being taught that. The Muslims are doing a great job of doing that.
Totally.
The Mormons
absolutely.
Do a great job. That is the fundamental building block of any religion, is the prohibition against questioning.
Yeah.
So critical thinking is the biggest enemy of any of these. Because
right.
it says, you know, maybe there's another map out there.
Yeah.
Maybe there's alternatives to the map that I've got.
Yeah, right. If you stumble upon one of these maps in your casual reading and you discover, oh my goodness, somebody else is thinking something totally different than what I've been taught, that puts this great conflict, you know, in play. And, you know, actually, I think it's a wonderful crucible for, you know, all of us to go through. But, you know, if organized religion, you know, is stifling that creativity or that investigation, there's going to be problems.
Yeah, right. Well, and the problems oftentimes come out in anger and lashing out and
right.
hatred of the other group.
Right, right. Or, and as you identified last week, self-hatred. So
yeah.
then we have these things like these closeted homosexuals who, you know, are populating the church hierarchy, at least in the Catholic Church, and they so hate themselves and who they are that they, you know, become, as we call them, killer fruit, and, you know, lash out, you know, at other gay and lesbian people. It's horrific.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you see it in the same in the Protestant world as well.
Yes.
Not unique right. to the Catholics,
right.
for
right.
sure.
Right. Right. So the second part of your book, starting with chapter 8, moves the discussion from theology to biology. So why did you see the need to develop this line of thinking?
If we think we need to understand ourselves as biological creatures.
Good.
And if we don't understand who we are, then we can't really understand what our human sexuality is, or what human sexuality is.
Exactly.
So I do talk about extensively in the book. I look at other primates. I look at other animals. I look at other creatures. Starting with the ducks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
one of my most popular talks is about sex. I call it sexy evolution. What the Pope doesn't know about sexuality.
Yes, which is a lot, I might add.
Yeah, right. It's very a lot. But I start off showing a duck penis. In live motion, a full motion picture of a duck mm-hmm. penis in action. And we start asking the question, at least what I'm trying to do in the book, is look at what evolution is doing to our bodies.
Right.
Every part of your body, every cell in your body is an expression of your sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
It has an X and a Y or an X and X chromosome or some combination thereof. So let's look at what this means. And it means that evolution has shaped things like our penis. Evolution is shaping women's bodies. Evolution is shaping our brains, hormones flowing, all this stuff. And I look at the bonobos, I look at the chimps, I look at gorillas, and I say, what's gorilla sexuality? And how's it different than bonobo and chimp sexuality? And, you know, those are very close relatives of ours. So how is our sexuality related or different or similar to theirs?
Right.
I'm not making the naturalistic fallacy here. I'm not saying because chimps do it, we should, or vice
yes,
versa.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm just saying, let's look at the whole panoply of sexualities out here. And then once you do, you'll realize human sexuality looks like gorilla sexuality, it looks like chimp sexuality, and it looks like bonobo sexuality. Humans are far more sexually flexible than our nearest primate relatives. And that just That, I think, is mind-boggling when you realize we are incredibly flexible in our sexuality. And what religion tries to do is take this huge sexuality and jack it down into a 1% of what we really and what we really can be. Now, unless we've talked earlier about spirituality and all, what we have as humans is the ability to relate to other humans through our sexuality in ways that the chimps and the gorillas don't. Bonobos do. The bonobos seem to relate to each other at deep levels through their sexuality. And I think we can too, only we've taken it to a whole new level.
Right.
I think the fundamental reason why we as humans are such a successful species on this planet is because of our sexuality. Because we use our sexuality to relate to other humans.
And there was a time in human history when sexuality was a vehicle for actually encountering the divine or the god. And, you know, so that has all been washed away, sadly, over the millennia, but it was there at one time.
Oh, yeah. So you get the sacred prostitutes.
Right,
of the,
exactly.
Of the Levant and Greece back in the, you know, 2,500 years ago. And there, you know, sacred prostitution was a pretty common thing among a lot of
In Judaism.
Yeah, even in Judaism, actually. Yeah. They try to erase that part of the Old Testament. Asherah still shows up in the Old Testament.
Right, it's so true. You got to be careful. They didn't clean it up all that well.
Yeah, they forgot to clean it up.
So let's talk a little bit about cultural anthropology. What role does this play?
I think, again, now that we've looked at the biology, now let's look at the way humans, not just primates, but humans express their sexuality. And what I found, and this just irritates me no end sometimes, is very well-educated secularists, humanists, atheists, whatever they call themselves, are very ignorant about other cultures and about how other people express their sexuality in other cultures. Mm-hmm. So that was why I wrote those chapters in the book. I want us to say, look, there are other cultures out there that are not infected with this patriarchal idea of religion. And by the way, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam are all patriarchal religions. Mm-hmm. Don't tell you any different. But if we can find cultures that are pre-patriarchal, what we will oftentimes find is they're much more friendly to female sexuality. They celebrate female sexuality. And I wanted to show that. For example, the Na culture in China is just mind-boggling. And there's other cultures in northern India that have similar viewpoints. In the Na culture, there is no word for father, wife, or husband, because marriage is not a part of that culture. And when the religious right says, you know, God created marriage, well, they haven't looked at the Na culture.
Yes, exactly.
That Na culture is a long time.
Well, that's again, you can say outrageously, you know, silly things because most people have no sense of history. They have no sense of the bigger picture. And, you know, so if, you know, Pope this or Cardinal that or Pastor so-and-so says this, we just sit there and go nod our heads. Well, he must be right because, you know, he went to school. I mean, it's criminal. It's absolutely criminal. We have to take some responsibility for being the object of this indoctrination, if you ask me.
Yeah, right. Well, so I wanted to educate the reader to the fact that there's other ways to look at human sexuality and other than the patriarchal. In the Na culture, the woman is in charge of the sexual relationship. The woman can have as many sexual partners as she wants. There is no adolescence there. We think adolescence, you know, Freud and all thought there was adolescence. Well, you know, there are cultures that don't even have an adolescence. In the Na culture, when the girl has her first menstrual cycle, she goes from childhood to womanhood instantly.
Yes.
She gets her own room. She gets her own door, external door. So she can invite men to come stay with her. And the only rule is the man has to be out of the house by morning. You don't get any breakfast in this house. And who the father is relevant because the uncles are the ones that are going to be the father figure.
Exactly.
The aunts and the uncles. So it's just a very different system. We know it's been going on for a long time because Marco Polo visited this particular culture. And so we got firsthand information from Marco Polo. Of course, he viewed this culture, the Na culture, through his Italian macho lens. Mm-hmm. he made some fundamental mistakes in interpreting this behavior.
Right.
But still, it's clear. And, you know, you look at other pre-contact Polynesian cultures, and the way feminine sexuality was celebrated in those cultures. And even after Christianity came along, in the Mangaean culture, for example, they've tried to make these folks stop screwing people they shouldn't be screwing,
right.
But they still do.
Yes.
And Mangaean people are supposedly Christian, but they don't let... a woman can have as many premarital sex partners as she wants, and nobody looks down their nose at them. Mm-hmm. So what we see is that, especially in these cultures, women have a very high sex drive. And if you take the shame and guilt out of it, women and allow women to express themselves, they don't go running hog wild. They have a good time. They have a good time with their bodies. They have a good time with men's bodies. Men have a good time with female bodies. But the incidence of rape, for example, is almost unheard of in these cultures.
Right.
To rape somebody if sex is something that...
it's available. Absolutely.
And you, it's all over. In many of these cultures, is sexual abuse and rape just is almost unheard of.
When women are in charge of sexuality, everyone gets more sex. So, you know, it's just, it seems really fruitless, you know, in the way that we have it set up.
Yeah.
So, one of the things that I've come to in my life, and it's been reinforced in the conversation that we've been having, is that basically the message of all of this is that we have made God, and I'm going to use the small g in God, in our image as opposed to the other way around, if there is such a divine creature. Both you and I, I've come to the conclusion that there isn't, but you know, we've created all of this kind of stuff. It hasn't been imposed upon us from the outside.
Right, right. Well, we in the corporate we.
Right, exactly that.
As a culture,
right.
And we created God in man's image, M-A-N. We forgot to create it in woman's.
Yes,
image.
There you have it.
Yeah, and. Previous to these patriarchal religions, the feminine was celebrated.
Absolutely.
And we see lots of evidence.
Absolutely.
Of feminine sexuality being
right.
An important part of culture. Now, it can also be a destructive part. I'm not saying that one is necessarily better or worse, but once the male side dominated, the religions went so far as to eliminate the female.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's what Judaism did. That's what Christianity did. And when they did bring the female back in, it was in the form of some Virgin Mary, who was a sexually active adolescent, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah, that's at least my view of her.
Yeah, right.
And she brings even more guilt back into the process.
Right.
And you look at Islam. Islam eliminated the female, too, from it all. So it's the patriarchal. I really try to show in the book how patriarchal religion was the demise of any opportunity to express our sexuality.
Right.
It's not other cultures pre-contact or pre-agriculture or pre-patriarchal religion didn't have some pretty nasty sexual practices.
Yeah.
Because they did. There were many that did.
Yeah.
Also many that didn't. And at least you had the opportunity. Once Christianity invades your culture, you're sunk.
Yeah. So, on so many levels, this is all really depressing, at least it is to me. Do you see any hope? I mean, are more and more people coming to their senses and leaving organized religion? Are we happier and perhaps even more sex positive once we liberate ourselves from this tyranny?
Well, I take a lot of hope in Sweden. I've been to Sweden.
Okay.
I've been to Sweden a couple times, and I'm just always amazed at how sexually open and free they are. It's kind of almost reverse of roles. Once, what we see in the research, not just in Sweden, but in Denmark and some of the other northern European countries particularly, is that once women gain political power and gain, get rid of religion, because remember, if you go to any church on any given Sunday morning, 60% of the attendees are female.
Mm-hmm.
And the males, many of the males are brought there kicking and screaming.
Yes.
So once you liberate women from the guilt of religion, and they start expressing themselves sexually, they generally don't go back.
Yes.
To the religious guilt stuff. Now, they may become New Age, they may become Wicca, they may become pagan, I don't care. But long,
right.
as long as they're going back to the patriarchal aspect,
right.
I see Sweden is so much more liberated. And, you know, the way marriage is being or not being expressed in Sweden, I mean, the marriage rates have just dropped precipitously in Sweden, among other places in Northern Europe. And they've gone almost in parallel with the drop in religiosity.
Yes.
But at the same time, I've visited many non-married people in Sweden who are raising two or three kids just fine.
Right. Before we conclude, just a couple questions. Who inspires you, and who are your sexual heroes, if you have any?
Well, I can say that Albert Ellis was probably my earliest inspiration.
Uh-huh.
He opened eyes to a whole lot of stuff, so I encourage people to look at him if they're interested. I also love Dosa Easton and Janet Hardy, the authors of The Ethical Slut.
Right.
I think they were great pioneers. And Deborah Annapole wrote Loving More way back in the 80s, and she's since updated that recently. I can't remember the name of it. But she's a hero of mine. I'm poly myself, so I find the poly people pretty interesting. And
I do too. Just if for nothing else, they fly in the face of the popular culture, and you know
absolutely
that
does.
Takes some cojones, as we say in the business.
And they're teaching communication skills that any so-called monogamous couple could learn
absolutely.
From.
Absolutely,
I think
totally
it's communication skills that's the interesting thing about this.
Right.
Also, I think Christopher Ryan's he's a big hero. He and Jeff are his partner. Just great, and I'm appreciative of what they're doing.
Right.
David Brash and his and Lipton, co-authors of The Myth of Monogamy. I think that book was just mind-blowing.
Right.
I love that book. If you're not familiar with it, or your listeners are interested.
Good.
So those are kind of my heroes and my inspirations. I could probably could name more, but those
absolutely.
Are the few.
So as we conclude, would you give us your website address again? Tell us where we can buy your book.
Yeah, IPCpress.com, and I will sign any book ordered at that
yay.
Location. And or Amazon, it's available on Amazon, both Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality, and my previous book, The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture. And they do not overlap very much. They're very different topics, and I think both topics are worth looking at.
Absolutely. I totally agree.
The author, I would think that, wouldn't I?
That's the beautiful part about being an author, don't you know? Well, my friend, it's been such a joy to spend so much time in your company. We are definitely the richer for the experience. And until we chat again, we will be visiting you in cyberspace.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, kiddo. Be well. What a delightful show. Well, that's it for today, sex fans. Tune in next time for more sex advice with an edge. With your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's Stockroom. Listen up, guys. If your sex life needs a little sprucing up, and whose doesn't, I want you to mosey on over to my online sex emporium and pick out something really naughty for yourself. Or one of the other pervs in your life. I mean, if you can't find what you're looking for in my stockroom, you just better call off the search right now.
You don't know how to have fun.
Oh, but I do, and you will too. Because Dr. Dick has put together a dazzling array of products that will liven up even the most ho-hum sex life. Not sure what to buy? Well, take a look at my sex toy reviews site, Dr. Dick, sextoyreviews.com. It's chocked full of swell gift-giving ideas. Look for Dr. Dick's stockroom banner in the sidebar of my site, and remember, a portion of every sale comes back to us as support for these shows. That's really great. And we thank Dr. Dick's stockroom and you, our wonderful customers. So until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.